Welcome to Well Told Tales, the Pulp Fiction Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Colligan. I also answer to the author formerly known as Finn Colgan. Finn Colgan was a pen name I used due to a day job which, thankfully, I don't have to worry about anymore. So old Finn will be retired, or in true Well Told Tales fashion, perhaps he'll meet a grisly fate, having something to do with an exotic neurotoxin, and being buried alive. Our Christmas episode is brought to you by CelebsWeb.com. That's Celeb with a Z, and then Web.com. CelebsWeb.com is a sister site to Well Told Tales. It's a commercial web design and services shop that specializes in building websites for entertainment professionals, including filmmakers, actors, writers, and artists of just about every stripe, as well as creative projects like independent films, short films, plays, and yes, even podcasts. Check us out at celebsweb.com, and if you buy something, mention that Well Told Tales sent you to receive a 20% discount. Well, I think I've done my part to commercialize Christmas. Without further ado, our story is Home for the Holidays, written by Randy Dawn and read by Andy Cat Germstad. Hope you enjoy it. Merry Christmas.
Home for the Holidays by Randy Dawn, read by Andy Cat. Giles Sanderson was a very bad man, but Jesus, he was a hell of a decorator. But maybe I'm getting ahead of myself a little here. Nathan Jacobs is the name, and this is my territory. Some call it a neighborhood, but when the houses are this damn huge and each comes with 3/4 acre of property, I start thinking of it as territory. I'm not alone. Folks around here mark their space better than dogs. Why, just take a turn onto our main drag off I-35 and you'll see 'em. 10-foot-high, wood slat fences, with no space between for even a casual peep. 'Cause Christ knows you shouldn't be eyeballing who's got Oprah on the tube, or who's throwing the ball with his kid, or even who's burying something under the old oak tree in the far back corner. Or in the case of Giles Sanderson, when you hauled off and backhanded your half-mex wife across the chops for not scurrying fast enough to get the mud clots off the Italian-tiled floors. Mud that you, Giles, had clomped in the first place. Well, you wouldn't want nobody to be seeing that. Yes, the backs of our territories are duly cut off from the rest of the world by the butt-ugliest of fences. But the front of those homes, well, that's a different story. We're Delians, you see. That's the computer giant that employs us and sets us up in these fine muck mansions. One cardboard cutout like the others, with just enough shades of difference in the rock facade or the hidden two-car garage or the overhanging porch to make it seem as though they were all thought up by original brains. But the truth is, they all look the same. And when you're driving past, they're just a blur of beige and gray, just like the dusty old ground that used to surround Austin before the builders came and resettled the place. Dell employees don't stay too long in one place. They come, they unpack, they get settled, wave a little at the locals, and then they're off again, relocated like army brats, only ruled by the whims of the computer industry. Houses in this area get to be 2-3 years old, and they've gone through about as many families. There are no long-timers. Except us, the Jacobses, or Jacobs if you're partial to the misprinted nameplate Jill bought me when we moved in. I've been here with her and the little ones, that's David and Astrid, going on 5 years now. I'm a Delian like the others, but I've got a snug little executive spot with a window overlooking. Well, overlooking I-35, but still overlooking. I know about half the folks who load in and load out of our little cul-de-sac. That's Tempest Cove to you. We wave and send over Jill's cranberry muffins when they arrive, and sometimes they wave back until they're waving goodbye a few months later. It happens. Giles Sanderson never was a Delian. He worked for one of those big box stores somewhere up in management with some kind of title that includes the word vice, and that's all I know about that. And, it turned out, his wife is allergic to cranberry. I still remember when they moved in, about 4 years ago, right directly southwest to our homestead.
Jill did her muffin thing, coming back to tell me that evening how the wife, never did get her name, stuck her head out that front door like a mouse from its hidey hole, took the basket, and darted right back in.
It was dark in there, Jill told me later, and they had the AC on, full blast, so I felt like I was peeking into a goddamn cave.
She also said that the wife had on sunglasses. Well, I put it out of my mind until our doorbell went that night, a big ho ho ho, because I'd bought that ringer with 17 different rings on it, and since it was past December 1st, we were gearing up for the big holiday season. But on the other side of my front door was like a big no no no. Without preliminary or nothing, Giles Sanderson, face all aflame like he was going to stroke out, pushed my wife's basket into my arms. A chewed-on muffin rolled onto the floor. Sharky, our golden retriever, shot forward and had it before Dust could even think about gathering. That retriever is a garbage disposal and no mistake.
"Just what the fuck do you think you're doing with my wife?" Sanderson steamed at me.
Behind me, I knew Jill was sticking her neck out of the kitchen. Such a loaded statement had to be seen to be believed.
"More importantly, what are you doing with my wife's basket?" I tried to get things light.
Folks in Texas, even near the civilized oasis of Austin, do love their firearms. Weirdly, it worked. The red went to pink and then to a sort of mottled orange-gray. Sanderson wasn't a very big man, with a flat-top crew cut an aircraft could have landed on, and his clothes were just a cat's whisker from being too tight. I got the picture. Former jock. Holding off middle age with both hands. Probably pumped iron 3 hours a day. Finally, when he realized I was kidding, he stuck out a meaty paw. Manicured fingernails glinted under our outside porch light.
"Sorry, overreacted. Just the wife's. She can't have berries. None. Blows her up like a balloon."
"No problem," I said, and took his hand. He squeezed it so I could feel the bones folding in. I'm not a small man myself, even if I never was a football player, but I know overcompensation when I see it, or feel it. This wasn't a handshake, this was a test. So I didn't wince, I just gave it back, and the handshake went on a few breaths longer than it should. A tap came on my shoulder and I let go. Jill came around and gave me a look warning about testosterone contests.
"Howdy," she said. "Jill Jacobs, so sorry I caused a fuss."
That Jill. She's a lady with the outside folks, but a wooden melt and all. With me, though, she's a real person and swears like a sailor. It's just one reason I love her. He turned red again, but this was a blush.
"Aw, sorry, ma'am, Giles Sanderson."
He pronounced it with a soft G and it all rhymed with piles.
I just bet he was the kind of guy who'd blast off if you pronounced it wrong.
"Nathan," I nodded his way.
"We just got in, and, well, it's a little funny to have a welcome wagon," he admitted, running his paw around the back of his neck. "Just never know who could come by and start offering food, so I got a little concerned."
Jill passed me a look. We knew folks who got concerned like that. It never ended well, and in the neighborhood where I grew up in North Austin, it could end up in blood, sweat, and tears, let's say. Suddenly, the wife's sunglasses inside made sense. Disarmed, Sanderson stood there and babbled a little longer, told us what they were doing here and how they didn't have kids but were hoping. And then the phone rang and we both begged off. When I shut the front door finally, I think everybody was relieved. "At least he won't be here long," I told her.
"How do you make that?" she asked.
"Because nobody stays here long.
Except us," she winked. "Muffin?"
So that's how it started. We met the Sandersons one at a time and that was it. They never waved back, so we didn't strike up a friendship. And I didn't have time, not in that December month, because I was getting geared up for one of my favorite things of all, dressing up the house.
Yeah, it might seem a little candy-ass, but when you got kids, you get into the whole cornball of everything. You sing with the Lion King, and you act like Dora's a fucking genius, and in a way, you actually believe it all, because, well, they do.
So starting when the kids were about 2 and 3, I got into the holidays all over again. Started with Halloween. Spook Day meant I could wire the house for sound and movement and make lights flash and witches fly, send up plumes of dry ice smoke and put the doorbell on to make it go woo. Every year there was more shit at the store to test out.
The skeleton I put in the front hallway, which lurched out at you when the door opened, scared off so many trick-or-treaters I had to retire it. But turning the garage into a haunted house brought him back. I reigned unquestioned supreme as Halloween House on Tempest Cove. Partly that was because of all the Jesus freaks around here got Halloween seen as anti-Christian. These evangelical nuts got all worked up over the fact that their favorite holidays might actually have, Saints preserve us, where are my smelling salts, pagan histories. So the competition I might have isn't participating. Oh sure, their kids go candy grubbing. Some of them even have the little ones show up with pamphlets, but they don't dress up and they don't decorate the house and they give you the hairy eyeball and the H&B when you start checking out the bowl with the mechanical hand that grabs back. So it didn't surprise me at all that Guile Sanderson's house was dark that first Halloween. Well, I thought about egging it, but in between the haunted house and taking Dave and Asty around the territory, I didn't have time. And then we all crashed out after too many Reese's peanut butter cups, so I shrugged my shoulders and let it go. Then came Christmas. Christmas. Now, that's a different animal. The neighborhood goes certifiable, I shit you not. Every year we go for a post-meal Thanksgiving constitutional. I need a walk before all that pie. And catch parents with their kids climbing trees and scaling ladders, already putting up the gaudy red and green lights, or staking out those blow-up Santas and snowmen to flap in the breeze for the next whole month. Every house, and I do mean every house, except for the ones not occupied, has some kind of decoration up, from Santa and his sleigh on the roof to multiple trees in the window. Just who needs more than one tree? Still, I was guilty too. I didn't start out to make it a competition, but my taste for fame got whetted with the Halloween success, and it felt like the area was looking to me to take the lead in decking the halls and bound the holly, so who was I to let him down? I wouldn't go gaudy. I did all white lights and maxed out with three things in the yard. We only had one tree, but it was tasteful, pleasant and clean and easy on the eye. Cars would slow drive on Tempest Cove and pause before our home. They took pictures, and then they'd ease on out, going a bit faster past all the rest. We had it down. We were kings of the cove. Not bad for an atheist and his lapsed Catholic wife. Then came Giles. He upped the ante. That first Christmas he came, he waited till we had our whole display out. I knew he was eyeballing us. You could see him, staring from his second floor media room window, cradling a cup of coffee in one hand, sipping it in slippered comfort while I banged the hell out of my fingers trying to get all the pieces in place. The day after I finished, Jill went out to snag the morning paper. She took so long coming back in, I went to see what was what. Sharky trotted alongside. That dog follows me everywhere. Bad news, I asked, nodding at the still folded paper under her arm. She slid her eyes over at the Sandersons. Son of a bitch, I muttered. Sanderson had mirrored our hard-designed, long-admired house, beautiful on his side of the cul-de-sac, down to the flickering candles in the windows. His house was a different model than ours, but there was no mistake. All white. Icicles from the eaves, candles in the window, and lighted deer frames on the lawn. But then I saw it. The deer heads were bobbing up and down, grazing. They were ghostly, ethereal, heartbreaking. My lawn looked like shit next to that. One small difference and it changed everything. Just then, Sanderson came out to get his paper. I started forward. Jill grabbed my robe, but I yanked it free. My slippers slapped against the tarmac as I pounded in his direction. You like? He winked at me. Has the ring of the familiar, I barked back. Behind Sanderson, a mouse stuck a head out the door, watching. Maddeningly, he shrugged. It's the most wonderful time of the year, he said. You stole my design, I shouted, knowing the whole neighborhood could hear, knowing I sounded like a four-year-old. I didn't give a rat's. He grinned. Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. Quit flattering me. And just like that, the grin still on his face, he gave me the finger. I took one step, and this time it wasn't Jill tapping on my shoulder. It was Asti and David, each grabbing an arm. "Daddy," they cried together. "Daddy, come see." I glanced down, wanting to shrug them off. I was livid, infuriated on some deep, instinctual level by this creep. But when I looked back up again, he was already inside. So I dropped it. The second year, I vowed to be bigger, and I was. We added on. Jill looked at me askew, but didn't say anything, and when Sanderson still did us one better, he had music synced to his lights for good mother's sake. The car slowed down to look at his place. Third year, he got so complex, he was hiring illegals to come out and help him get all the decorations up. That year, the local paper did a story on his designs, and then the local news picked it up and got it put on the internet and landed about 100,000 hits or something ridiculous. We were left in the dust. Only we shouldn't have been. We still had a kick-ass set of decorations, but every time I brought in a new innovation, words on the roof, light panels in the driveway. Sanderson had one more trick up his too tight sleeve, and it was always the one thing that made his place perfect, and my place like an amateur's. Taste went out the window that third year, and Jill even complained. "I can't find our front door anymore with all of this shit," she told me. "I'm blind just carrying in the groceries." "Use the garage," I snapped. And when she tried to take one or two items down when I wasn't home, it was my turn to blow my top. We retired into our bathroom and had it out. She made perfect sense, and I was completely unreasonable in return, but it was the only thing I became immobile with her on. "Do not fuck with my decorations," I told her. "It's the principle of the matter." And then she threw up her hands and said she was learning to hate this holiday. Strangely, so was I. Meanwhile, Sanderson took in the accolades and the applause, always him doing the talking, his wife standing in the back behind, blinking with wide, dark eyes. Then the news trucks would disappear, and his house continued to blare out at the rest of the street with its permanent snowfall and eternal pine scent. If you stood outside to admire it in the late, late hours, you might even catch some sound from the house. Noises that had nothing to do with December celebrations. No, the screaming and the shifting and the breaking reminded me much more of Halloween than Christmas. This year, Jill said she had enough. They were going to spend Christmas with her parents in Colorado, and I could come or I could sit at home and stare at Sanderson's like Pink does at the TV in the wall. She didn't give a shit. Of course, she did give a shit, but that's how she puts on a brave face. You see, this year what broke her was the contest. I don't know for positive, but I'm pretty goddamn sure that Sanderson was behind the institution of the holiday decoration contest with the local news station. You know, the one that got him on the internet a few years back? It was co-sponsored by a local rag which had printed that his decorations were elegantly reflective of the joy the holiday brings, or some other highfalutin crap. Basically, everyone in this zip code could enter. All you gotta do is decorate, send in a 3-minute video about your place, and the finalists got a visit from the station's judging committee. The winner? A blue ribbon, and a picture in the paper, and $100. So obviously it wasn't about the ribbon, or the paper, or the $100. It's the fucking principle of the matter. The last 4 years, this joker had stolen every good idea I got and colored outside the lines and gotten outside help and then took it to the media, which made everybody start upping their game until our whole neighborhood turned into one of those side streets at Disneyland. It was the least happiest place on earth, though. I kissed Jill and the kidlets goodbye at Austin Bergstrom and told them I'd be along directly but had to stick at work for some last-minute development meetings. Jill gave me another hairy eyeball like she didn't think I was really going to show. I kissed her again and promised to make it. "When was the last time I let you down?" I asked her, and she had to look away. She knows I don't go back on my word. The plane took off, and I left the car at the airport, taking a cab that cost me more than the prize money would have, sneaking in the back door of my place just as full dark came on. I don't think anybody saw me. They shouldn't have, since I left all of our decorations turned off. We were out of town, nobody home. I took a quick look at his handiwork, which glowed even more bright now that it didn't have to compete with mine.
I caught the live-action Santa in the front yard, grinning away, waving his hand, leaning back in his big old ugly sleigh, and I gave him the finger. It wasn't but a quick walk across the street to Sanderson's, but I had to be circumspect. I went out the back again, all dressed in black, with my hunting knife hid good and tight in its sheath against my leg. I got low to the ground and hugged that blockade wood fence that keeps all of us safe and tight from prying eyes, swooping around the back of the Browns, the Changs, and the Cohens, until there I was, in the one place Sanderson didn't want to be observed, his own backyard. I hunkered next to his backyard deck, behind the grill, and waited. It was quiet, and that was odd because, except on Halloween night, I knew the Sandersons never went out, never had people in, never went on vacation. Sanderson came home from work every night at 7:30 and was gone again by 6 in the morning. When he was home, mostly all you heard was the TV blaring, except for the nights when you couldn't sleep and you got a breath of fresh air outside and could hear the whimpering or the moaning in the late night. So late it was really morning. But now, I heard nothing. Something wet came out of the branches and fastened on my hand, and I jumped a mile.
"Jesus Christ, dog!" I growled at him.
Sharky, who followed me everywhere, thought we were playing a game.
"Git! Go home!"
He didn't move.
"Aw, fuck, animal!" I said, and gave him the one command he did obey. "Lie down!"
Immediately, his blonde bulk dropped flat and his nose went between his paws. He would stay like that until the earth opened up under him or until I gave the signal.
"Good dog!"
I glanced off to my right. There it was, the one thing I was looking for. Same spot as on my McMansion. I pried open the fuse box with a lockpick, preparing to mess up the innards with my knife. Nobody was going to give out a prize to a house that couldn't even get itself lit. That was all I was going to have to do, and then I could receive the judges with open arms the next morning, just a few hours before my flight was taken off. I had just pulled out the knife when I heard the thud. It was a dull, crashing thing, but it all came as one big noise, as if somebody had dropped a sack of laundry from a height. I froze and glanced at Sharky, who had an eyebrow cocked but had not moved. Inching over to the deck, I crouched down low just as the backyard light popped on and the glass backyard door slid open. A figure emerged, pulling something behind it. A mouse, lacing her fingers under the armpits of a former jock, taking minute backward steps onto the deck. Her breathing came hard and fast, audible even above the shushing of his clothes against the wooden deck slats. She stopped and righted herself, and then I heard soft sobs.
"Hey,"
I said, standing tall, the knife resheathed.
"You okay?"
The mouse whipped around, her eyes wide and staring. One seemed sunken in, almost blending with her boy-cropped brown hair. It was a shiner, like none I'd seen, and it got my blood boiling. The light cut across her mouth, and I caught a crust of blood in one of the corners, a rough texture against the swelling there.
"It's okay,"
I said, staring down at Guile Sanderson. Let's just say he looked much, much worse than the mouse, thanks to having his skull stove in. From the size of it, I'd say she clocked him with a vase, or maybe a pot, maybe even a claw hammer. It didn't matter. He wasn't breathing. Is it wrong to say I felt a small thrill run up my backside? I caught my flight with plenty of time to spare the next morning. For once, Delta was on time, and I knew I'd be with Jill and the kids in time to see them opening the gifts. But I was also glad to have a few hours more to rest. Every muscle in me was aching by the time I got on board. You see, I didn't have much time to sleep that evening. The mouse and I, you know, I never did get her name, had to expend a lot of energy making sure Giles wouldn't be found, at least not right away. At first she wanted to bury him under the tree and pretend he vanished, but I told her that was going to look suspicious in about 5 minutes, and then they'd bring out the dogs and sniff him out and it wouldn't work. What she needed to do was just be out of town for the holidays. Leave the house look broken into, I'd take care of the rest. So at 2 in the morning she was packing, and at 3 she was headed to the train station, and at 4 I was doing a little more decoration on Guile Sanderson's house. Well, it still looks like mine, of course. Yes, there's always that one extra bit that completely fucks with my design and elevates his. But this year, I'm the one who made the adjustment. It's a very personal addition. A lifelike, human-sized Santa figure in full costume, propped up in a sleigh on the front lawn. The reins are in his paw-like mittened hands, and the mask over his face makes him eternally jolly and delightful. Can't do much about the lack of a twinkle in his eye, though. It's too bad it isn't Vermont, but Texas has been cold these last few seasons, so I don't think anyone will say anything about Santa's body odor. At least until Dick Clark is counting the ball falling, by which time the mouse will have returned and noted her husband missing, and the search will commence. Nobody will ever think her capable of causing him harm, and nobody will certainly think she could have moved him that far, and by then all of her injuries should be well healed. I know it may seem counterproductive to add to Sanderson's landscape. The Santa figure lends a touch of fantastical reality that no other house, including mine, can approach. There's no doubt that Giles Sanderson will win the contest this year. But he hasn't got a chance in hell next Christmas.
And that's our story. In fact, it's our last story of 2008. So I just want to take a minute to thank all of our loyal subscribers and listeners, and wish you the happiest of holidays. We'll be back in January 2009 with some exciting changes. More on that in a future episode. I've got some eggnog to drink. Happy holidays.